Chapter 11. The Firebolt. Harry didn't have a very clear idea of how he had managed to get back into the Honeyduke's cellar, through the tunnel and into the castle once more. All he knew was that the return trip seemed to take no time at all, and that he hardly noticed what he was doing because his head was still pounding with the conversation he had just heard. Why had nobody ever told him? Dumbledore, Hagrid, Mr. Weasley, Cornelius Fudge, why hadn't anyone ever mentioned the fact that Harry's parents had died because their best friend had betrayed them? Ron and Hermione watched Harry nervously all through dinner, not daring to talk about what they'd overheard, because Percy was sitting close by them. When they went upstairs to the crowded common room, it was to find Fred and George had set off half a dozen dung bombs in a fit of end-of-term high spirits. Harry, who didn't want Fred and George asking him whether he'd reached Hogsmeade or not, sneaked quietly up to the empty dormitory and headed straight for his bedside cabinet. He pushed his books aside and quickly found what he was looking for. The leather-bound photo album Hagrid had given him 2 years ago, which was full of wizard pictures of his mother and father. He sat down on his bed, drew the hangings around him, and started turning the pages, searching, until he stopped on a picture of his parents' wedding day. There was his father, waving up at him, beaming, the untidy black hair Harry had inherited standing up in all directions. There was his mother, alight with happiness, arm in arm with his dad. And there, that must be him, their best man. Harry had never given him a thought before. If he hadn't known it was the same person, he would never have guessed it was black in this old photograph. His face wasn't sunken and waxy, but handsome, full of laughter. Had he already been working for Voldemort when this picture was taken? Was he already planning the deaths of the two people next to him? Did he realize he was facing 12 years in Azkaban, 12 years which would make him unrecognizable? But the Dementors don't affect him, Harry thought, staring into the handsome, laughing face. He doesn't have to hear my mum screaming if they get too close. Harry slammed the album shut, reached over and stuffed it back into his cabinet, took off his robes and glasses, and got into bed, making sure the hangings were hiding him from view. The dormitory door opened. "Harry?" said Ron's voice uncertainly. But Harry lay still, pretending to be asleep. He heard Ron leave again, and rolled over on his back, his eyes wide open. A hatred, such as he had never known before, was coursing through Harry like poison. He could see Black laughing at him through the darkness, as though somebody had pasted the picture from the album over his eyes. He watched, as though somebody was playing him a piece of film, Sirius Black blasting Peter Pettigrew, who resembled Neville Longbottom, into 1,000 pieces. He could hear, though he had no idea what Black's voice might sound like, a low, excited mutter. "It has happened, my lord. The Potters have made me their secret keeper." And then came another voice, laughing shrilly, the same laugh that Harry heard inside his head whenever the Dementors drew near.
"Harry, you look terrible."
Harry hadn't gone to sleep until daybreak. He had awoken to find the dormitory deserted, dressed, and gone down the spiral staircase to a common room that was completely empty, except for Ron, who was eating a peppermint toad and massaging his stomach, and Hermione, who had spread her homework over 3 tables.
"Where is everyone?" said Harry.
"Gone! It's the first day of the holidays, remember?"
said Ron, watching Harry closely.
"It's nearly lunchtime. I was going to come and wake you up in a minute."
Harry slumped into a chair next to the fire. Snow was still falling outside the windows. Crookshanks was spread out in front of the fire like a large ginger rug.
"You really don't look well, you know," Hermione said, peering anxiously into his face.
"I'm fine," said Harry.
"Harry, listen," said Hermione, exchanging a look with Ron. "You must be really upset about what we heard yesterday, but the thing is, you mustn't go doing anything stupid."
"Like what?" said Harry.
"Like trying to go after Black," said Ron sharply.
Harry could tell they had rehearsed this conversation while he had been asleep. He didn't say anything.
"You won't, will you, Harry?" said Hermione.
"Because Black's not worth dying for," said Ron. Harry looked at them. They didn't seem to understand at all.
"Do you know what I see and hear every time a Dementor gets too near me?"
Ron and Hermione shook their heads, looking apprehensive.
"I can hear my mum screaming and pleading with Voldemort. And if you'd heard your mum screaming like that, just about to be killed, you wouldn't forget it in a hurry. And if you found out someone who was supposed to be a friend of hers betrayed her and sent Voldemort after her—" "There's nothing you can do," said Hermione, looking stricken. "The Dementors will catch Black, and he'll go back to Azkaban and serve him right."
"You heard what Fudge said. Black isn't affected by Azkaban like normal people are. It's not a punishment for him like it is for the others."
"So what are you saying?" said Ron, looking very tense. "You want to kill Black or something?"
"Don't be silly," said Hermione in a panicky voice. "Harry doesn't want to kill anyone, do you, Harry?"
Again, Harry didn't answer. He didn't know what he wanted to do. All he knew was that the idea of doing nothing while Black was at liberty was almost more than he could stand.
"Malfoy knows," he said abruptly. "Remember what he said to me in Potions? If it was me, I'd hunt him down myself. I'd want revenge."
"You're going to take Malfoy's advice instead of ours?" said Ron furiously. "Listen, you know what Pettigrew's mother got back after Black had finished with him? Dad told me. The Order of Merlin, first class, and Pettigrew's finger in a box. That was the biggest bit of him they could find. Black's a madman, Harry, and he's dangerous."
"Malfoy's dad must have told him," said Harry, ignoring Ron. "He was right in Voldemort's inner circle."
"Say you know who, will you?" interjected Ron angrily.
So obviously the Malfoys knew Black was working for Voldemort.
"And Malfoy'd love to see you blown into about a million pieces, like Pettigrew. Get a grip! Malfoy's just hoping you'll get yourself killed before he has to play you at Quidditch."
"Harry, please," said Hermione, her eyes now shining with tears.
"Please be sensible. Black did a terrible, terrible thing, but don't put yourself in danger. It's what Black wants. Oh, Harry, you'd be playing right into Black's hands if you went looking for him. Your mum and dad wouldn't want you to get hurt, would they? They'd never want you to go looking for Black."
"I'll never know what they'd have wanted, because thanks to Black, I've never spoken to them," said Harry shortly. There was a silence, in which Crookshanks stretched luxuriously, flexing his claws. Ron's pocket quivered.
"Look," said Ron, obviously casting around for a change of subject. "It's the holidays. It's nearly Christmas. Let's go down and see Hagrid. We haven't visited him for ages."
"No," said Hermione quickly.
"Harry isn't supposed to leave the castle, Ron."
"Yeah, let's go," said Harry, sitting up. "And I can ask him how come he never mentioned Black when he told me all about my parents." Further discussion of Sirius Black plainly wasn't what Ron had had in mind.
"Or we could have a game of chess," he said hastily, "or gobstones. Percy left a set."
"No, let's visit Hagrid," said Harry firmly. So they got their cloaks from their dormitories and set off through the portrait hole.
"Stand and fight, you yellow-bellied mongrels!"
Down through the empty castle and out through the oak front doors. They made their way slowly down the lawn, making a shallow trench in the glittering, powdery snow, their socks and the hems of their cloaks soaked and freezing. The Forbidden Forest looked as though it had been enchanted, each tree smattered with silver, and Hagrid's cabin looked like an iced cake. Ron knocked, but there was no answer.
"He's not out, is he?"
said Hermione, who was shivering under her cloak. Ron had his ear to the door.
"There's a weird noise," he said. "Listen, is that Fang?"
Harry and Hermione put their ears to the door too. From inside the cabin came a series of low, throbbing moans.
"Think we'd better go and get someone," said Ron nervously.
"Hagrid!" called Harry, thumping the door. "Hagrid, are you in there?" There was a sound of heavy footsteps. Then the door creaked open. Hagrid stood there with his eyes red and swollen, tears splashing down the front of his leather waistcoat.
"You've heard!"
he bellowed, and he flung himself onto Harry's neck. Hagrid being at least twice the size of a normal man, this was no laughing matter. Harry, about to collapse under Hagrid's weight, was rescued by Ron and Hermione, who each seized Hagrid under an arm and heaved him, Harry helping, back into the cabin. Hagrid allowed himself to be steered into a chair and slumped over the table, sobbing uncontrollably, his face glazed with tears which dripped down into his tangled beard. "Hagrid, what is it?" said Hermione, aghast. Harry spotted an official-looking letter lying open on the table. "What's this, Hagrid?" Hagrid's sobs redoubled, but he shoved the letter towards Harry, who picked it up and read aloud. "Dear Mr. Hagrid, further to our inquiry into the attack by a hippogriff on a student in your class, we have accepted the assurances of Professor Dumbledore that you bear no responsibility for the regrettable incident." "Well, that's okay then, Hagrid," said Ron, clapping Hagrid on the shoulder. But Hagrid continued to sob and waved one of his gigantic hands, inviting Harry to read on. "However, we must register our concern about the hippogriff in question. We have decided to uphold the official complaint of Mr. Lucius Malfoy, and this matter will therefore be taken to the Committee for the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures. The hearing will take place on April the 20th, and we ask you to present yourself and your hippogriff at the committee's offices in London on that date. In the meantime, the hippogriff should be kept tethered and isolated. Yours in fellowship." There followed a list of the school governors. "Oh," said Ron. "But you said Buckbeak isn't a bad hippogriff, Hagrid. I bet he'll get off."
"You don't know them gargoyles at the Committee for the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures,"
choked Hagrid, wiping his eyes on his sleeve.
"They've got it in for interest in creatures."
A sudden sound from the corner of Hagrid's cabin made Harry, Ron and Hermione whip around. Buckbeak the hippogriff was lying in the corner, chomping on something that was oozing blood all over the floor.
"I couldn't leave him tied up out there in the snow," choked Hagrid, "all on his own, at Christmas."
Harry, Ron and Hermione looked at each other. They had never seen eye to eye with Hagrid about what he called interesting creatures, and other people called terrifying monsters. On the other hand, there didn't seem to be any particular harm in Buckbeak. In fact, by Hagrid's usual standards, he was positively cute.
"You'll have to put up a good strong defence, Hagrid," said Hermione, sitting down and laying a hand on Hagrid's massive forearm. "I'm sure you can prove Buckbeak is safe."
"Won't make no difference," sobbed Hagrid. "Them disposal devils, they're all in Lucius Malfoy's pocket, scared of him. And if I lose the case, Buckbeak—"
Hagrid drew his finger swiftly across his throat, then gave a great wail and lurched forwards, his face in his arms.
"What about Dumbledore, Hagrid?" said Harry.
"He's done more'n enough for me already,"
groaned Hagrid. "Got enough on his plate, what with keeping them Dementors out of the castle and Sirius Black lurking around."
Ron and Hermione looked quickly at Harry, as though expecting him to start berating Hagrid for not telling him the truth about Black. But Harry couldn't bring himself to do it, not now he saw Hagrid so miserable and scared.
"Listen, Hagrid," he said, "you can't give up. Hermione's right. You just need a good defence. You can call us as witnesses."
"I'm sure I've read about a case of hippogriff baiting," said Hermione, thoughtfully, "where the hippogriff got off. I'll look it up for you, Hagrid, and see exactly what happened." Hagrid howled still more loudly. Harry and Hermione looked at Ron to help them.
"Shall I make a cup of tea?" said Ron.
Harry stared at him. "That's what my mum does whenever someone's upset," Ron muttered, shrugging. At last, after many more assurances of help, with a steaming mug of tea in front of him, Hagrid blew his nose on a handkerchief the size of a tablecloth and said,
"You're right. I can't afford to go to pieces. Got to pull myself together."
Fang, the boarhound, came timidly out from under the table and laid his head on Hagrid's knee.
"I've not been myself lately,"
said Hagrid, stroking Fang with one hand and mopping his face with the other.
"Worried about Buckbeak and no one liking my classes."
"We do like them," lied Hermione at once. "Yeah, they're great," said Ron, crossing his fingers under the table.
How are the flobberworms?
Dead, said Hagrid gloomily. Too much lettuce.
Oh, no, said Ron, his lip twitching.
And them dementors make me feel ruddy terrible and all, said Hagrid with a sudden shudder. Got to walk past him every time I want a drink in the Three Broomsticks. It's like being back in Azkaban.
He fell silent, gulping his tea. Harry, Ron and Hermione watched him breathlessly. They had never heard Hagrid talk about his brief spell in Azkaban before. After a brief pause, Hermione said timidly, "Is it awful in there, Hagrid?"
"You've no idea," said Hagrid quietly. "Never been anywhere like it. Thought I was going mad. Kept going over horrible stuff in my mind. The day I got expelled from Hogwarts, day my dad died, day I had to let Norbert go."
His eyes filled with tears. Norbert was the baby dragon Hagrid had once won in a game of cards.
"You can't really remember who you are after a while, and you can't see the point of living at all. I used to hope I'd just die in my sleep. When they let me out, it was like being born again. Everything came flooding back. It was the best feeling in the world. Mind, the Dementors weren't keen on letting me go."
"But you were innocent," said Hermione. Hagrid snorted.
"Think that matters to them? They don't care. Long as they've got a couple of hundred humans stuck there with them, so they can leech all the happiness out of them, they don't give a damn who's guilty and who's not."
Hagrid went quiet for a moment, staring into his tea. Then he said quietly,
"Thought of just letting Buckbeak go, trying to make him fly away. But how do you explain to a hippogriff it's got to go into hiding? And I'm scared of breaking the law."
He looked up at them, tears leaking down his face again.
"I don't ever want to go back to Azkaban."
The trip to Hagrid's, though far from fun, had nevertheless had the effect Ron and Hermione had hoped. Though Harry had by no means forgotten about Black, he couldn't brood constantly on revenge if he wanted to help Hagrid win his case against the Committee for the Disposal of Dangerous Creatures. He, Ron and Hermione went to the library next day and returned to the empty common room laden with books which might help prepare a defence for Buckbeak. The three of them sat in front of the roaring fire, slowly turning the pages of dusty volumes about famous cases of marauding beasts, speaking occasionally when they ran across something relevant. "Here's something. There was a case in 1722, but the hippogriff was convicted. Ooh, look what they did to it. That's disgusting. This might help. Look, a manticore savaged someone in 1296, and they let the manticore off. Oh, no, that was only because everyone was too scared to go near it." Meanwhile, in the rest of the castle, the usual magnificent Christmas decorations had been put up, despite the fact that hardly any of the students remained to enjoy them. Thick streamers of holly and mistletoe were strung along the corridors, mysterious lights shone from inside every suit of armour, and the great hall was filled with its usual 12 Christmas trees, glittering with golden stars. A powerful and delicious smell of cooking pervaded the corridors, and by Christmas Eve it had grown so strong that even Scabbers poked his nose out of the shelter of Ron's pocket to sniff hopefully at the air. On Christmas morning, Harry was woken by Ron throwing his pillow at him.
"Oi! Presents!"
Harry reached for his glasses and put them on, squinting through the semi-darkness to the foot of his bed, where a small heap of parcels had appeared. Ron was already ripping the paper off his own presents.
"Another jumper from Mum? Maroon again! See if you've got one."
Harry had. Mrs. Weasley had sent him a scarlet jumper with the Gryffindor lion knitted on the front. Also, a dozen home-baked mince pies, some Christmas cake, and a box of nut brittle. As he moved all these things aside, he saw a long, thin package lying underneath.
"What's that?"
said Ron, looking over, a freshly unwrapped pair of maroon socks in his hand.
"Dunno."
Harry ripped the parcel open and gasped as a magnificent, gleaming broomstick rolled out onto his bedspread. Ron dropped his socks and jumped off his bed for a closer look.
"I don't believe it," he said hoarsely.
It was a firebolt, identical to the dream broom Harry had gone to see every day in Diagon Alley. Its handle glittered as he picked it up. He could feel it vibrating,
and let go. It hung in mid-air, unsupported, at exactly the right height for him to mount it. His eyes moved from the golden registration number at the top of the handle right down to the perfectly smooth, streamlined birch twigs that made up the tail.
"Who sent it to you?" said Ron in a hushed voice.
"Look and see if there's a card," said Harry. Ron ripped apart the firebolt's wrappings.
"Nothing. Blimey, who'd spend that much on you?"
"Well," said Harry, feeling stunned, "I'm betting it wasn't the Dursleys."
"I bet it was Dumbledore," said Ron, now walking round and round the firebolt, taking in every glorious inch. "He sent you the invisibility cloak anonymously."
"That was my dad's, though," said Harry. "Dumbledore was just passing it on to me. He wouldn't spend hundreds of galleons on me. He can't go giving students stuff like this."
"That's why he wouldn't say it was from him," said Ron, "in case some git like Malfoy said it was favouritism."
"Hey, Harry!"
Ron gave a great whoop of laughter.
"Malfoy! Wait till he sees you on this. He'll be sick as a pig. This is an international standard broom, this is!"
"I can't believe this," Harry muttered, running a hand along the firebolt, while Ron sank onto Harry's bed, laughing his head off at the thought of Malfoy.
"Who?"
"I know," said Ron, controlling himself. "I know who it could have been. Lupin."
"What?"
said Harry, now starting to laugh himself.
"Lupin? Listen, if he had this much gold, he'd be able to buy himself some new robes."
"Yeah, but he likes you," said Ron, "and he was away when your Nimbus got smashed, and he might have heard about it and decided to visit Diagon Alley and get this for you."
"What do you mean he was away?" said Harry. "He was ill when I was playing in that match."
"Well, he wasn't in the hospital wing," said Ron. "I was there, cleaning out the bedpans on that detention from Snape, remember?"
Harry frowned at Ron.
"I can't see Lupin affording something like this."
"What are you two laughing about?"
Hermione had just come in, wearing her dressing gown and carrying Crookshanks, who was looking very grumpy, with a string of tinsel tied around his neck.
"Don't bring him in here," said Ron, hurriedly snatching Scabbers from the depths of his bed and stowing him in his pyjama pocket.
But Hermione wasn't listening. She dropped Crookshanks onto Seamus's empty bed and stared, open-mouthed, at the firebolt.
"Oh, Harry, who sent you that?"
"No idea," said Harry. "There wasn't a card or anything with it." To his great surprise, Hermione did not appear either excited or intrigued by this news. On the contrary, her face fell, and she bit her lip.
"What's the matter with you?" said Ron.
"I don't know," said Hermione slowly. "But it's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, this is supposed to be quite a good broom, isn't it?"
Ron sighed exasperatedly. "It's the best broom there is, Hermione," he said.
"So it must have been really expensive."
"Probably cost more than all the Slytherin's brooms put together," said Ron happily.
"Well, who'd send Harry something as expensive as that and not even tell him they'd sent it?"
said Hermione.
"Who cares?" said Ron impatiently. "Listen, Harry, can I have a go on it? Can I?"
"I don't think anyone should ride that broom just yet,"
said Hermione shrilly.
Harry and Ron looked at her.
"What do you think Harry's going to do with it? Sweep the floor?" said Ron. But before Hermione could answer, Crookshanks sprang from Seamus's bed right at Ron's chest.
"Get him out of here!"
Ron bellowed as Crookshanks' claws ripped his pyjamas and Scabbers attempted a wild escape over his shoulder. Ron seized Scabbers by the tail and aimed a misjudged kick at Crookshanks, which hit the trunk at the end of Harry's bed, knocking it over and causing Ron to hop on the spot, howling with pain. Crookshanks's fur suddenly stood on end. A shrill, tinny whistling was filling the room. The pocket sneakerscope had become dislodged from Uncle Vernon's old socks and was whirling and gleaming on the floor.
"I forgot about that," Harry said, bending down and picking up the sneakerscope. "I never wear those socks if I can help it."
The sneakerscope whirled and whistled in his palm. Crookshanks was hissing and spitting at it.
"You'd better take that cat out of here, Hermione," said Ron furiously.
He was sitting on Harry's bed, nursing his toe.
"Can't you shut that thing up?" he added to Harry, as Hermione strode out of the room, Crookshanks's yellow eyes still fixed maliciously on Ron. Harry stuffed the sneakerscope back inside the socks and threw it back into his trunk. All that could be heard now were Ron's stifled moans of pain and rage. Scabbers was huddled in Ron's hands. It had been a while since Harry had seen him out of Ron's pocket, and he was unpleasantly surprised to see that Scabbers, once so fat, was now very skinny. Patches of fur seemed to have fallen out too. "He's not looking too good, is he?" Harry said.
"It's stress," said Ron. "He'd be fine if that stupid great furball left him alone."
But Harry, remembering what the woman at the magical menagerie had said about rats only living 3 years, couldn't help feeling that unless Scabbers had powers he had never revealed, he was reaching the end of his life. And despite Ron's frequent complaints that Scabbers was both boring and useless, he was sure Ron would be very miserable if Scabbers died. Christmas spirit was definitely thin on the ground in the Gryffindor common room that morning. Hermione had shut Crookshanks in her dormitory, but was furious with Ron for trying to kick him. Ron was still fuming about Crookshanks's fresh attempt to eat Scabbers. Harry gave up trying to make them talk to each other and devoted himself to examining the firebolt, which he had brought down to the common room with him. For some reason, this seemed to annoy Hermione as well. She didn't say anything, but she kept looking darkly at the broom as though it, too, had been criticizing her cat. At lunchtime they went down to the great hall to find that the house tables had been moved against the walls again, and that a single table, set for 12, stood in the middle of the room. Professors Dumbledore, McGonagall, Snape, Sprout, and Flitwick were there, along with Filch, the caretaker, who had taken off his usual brown coat and was wearing a very old and rather mouldy-looking tailcoat. There were only 3 other students, 2 extremely nervous-looking first years, and a sullen-faced Slytherin fifth year.
"Merry Christmas," said Dumbledore, as Harry, Ron, and Hermione approached the table. "As there are so few of us, it seemed foolish to use the house tables. Sit down, sit down."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione sat down side by side at the end of the table.
"Crackers," said Dumbledore enthusiastically, offering the end of a large silver one to Snape, who took it reluctantly and tugged. With a bang like a gunshot, the cracker flew apart to reveal a large, pointed witch's hat topped with a stuffed vulture.
Harry, remembering the boggart, caught Ron's eye and they both grinned. Snape's mouth thinned, and he pushed the hat towards Dumbledore, who swapped it for his wizard's hat at once.
"Tuck in," he advised the table, beaming around.
As Harry was helping himself to roast potatoes, the doors of the great hall opened again. It was Professor Trelawney gliding towards them as though on wheels. She had put on a green sequined dress in honour of the occasion, making her look more than ever like a glittering, oversized dragonfly.
"Sibyl, this is a pleasant surprise," said Dumbledore, standing up.
"I have been crystal-gazing, headmaster," said Professor Trelawney in her mistiest, most far-away voice. "And to my astonishment, I saw myself abandoning my solitary luncheon and coming to join you. Who am I to refuse the promptings of fate? I at once hastened from my tower, and I do beg you to forgive my lateness."
"Certainly, certainly," said Dumbledore, his eyes twinkling. "Let me draw you up a chair." And he did indeed draw a chair in mid-air with his wand, which revolved for a few seconds before falling with a thud between Professors Snape and McGonagall. Professor Trelawney, however, did not sit down. Her enormous eyes had been roving around the table, and she suddenly uttered a kind of soft scream.
"I dare not, headmaster. If I join the table, we shall be 13. Nothing could be more unlucky. Never forget that when 13 dine together, the first to rise will be the first to die."
"We'll risk it, Sibyl," said Professor McGonagall impatiently. "Do sit down. The turkey's getting stone cold."
Professor Trelawney hesitated, then lowered herself into the empty chair, eyes shut and mouth clenched tight, as though expecting a thunderbolt to hit the table. Professor McGonagall poked a large spoon into the nearest tureen.
"Tripe, Sibyl?"
Professor Trelawney ignored her. Eyes open again, she looked around once more and said, "But where is dear Professor Lupin?"
"I am afraid the poor fellow is ill again," said Dumbledore, indicating that everybody should start serving themselves. "Most unfortunate that it should happen on Christmas Day."
"But surely you already knew that, Sybil," said Professor McGonagall, her eyebrows raised.
Professor Trelawney gave Professor McGonagall a very cold look.
"Certainly I knew, Minerva," she said quietly, "but one does not parade the fact that one is all-knowing. I frequently act as though I am not possessed of the inner eye, so as not to make others nervous."
"That explains a great deal," said Professor McGonagall tartly.
Professor Trelawney's voice suddenly became a good deal less misty. "If you must know, Minerva, I have seen that poor Professor Lupin will not be with us for very long. He seems aware himself that his time is short. He positively fled when I offered to crystal gaze for him."
"Imagine that," said Professor McGonagall dryly.
"I doubt," said Dumbledore, in a cheerful but slightly raised voice, which put an end to Professor McGonagall and Professor Trelawney's conversation, "that Professor Lupin is in any immediate danger. Severus, you've made the potion for him again?"
"Yes, headmaster," said Snape.
"Good," said Dumbledore. "Then he should be up and about in no time. Derrick, have you had any of these chipolatas? They're excellent."
The first-year boy went furiously red on being addressed directly by Dumbledore and took the platter of sausages with trembling hands. Professor Trelawney behaved almost normally until the very end of Christmas dinner, 2 hours later. Full to bursting with Christmas dinner, and still wearing their cracker hats, Harry and Ron got up first from the table, and she shrieked loudly,
"My dears! Which of you left his seat first? Which?"
"Dunno," said Ron, looking uneasily at Harry.
"I doubt it will make much difference," said Professor McGonagall coldly, "unless a mad axeman is waiting outside the doors to slaughter the first into the entrance hall."
Even Ron laughed. Professor Trelawney looked highly affronted.
"Coming," Harry said to Hermione.
"No," Hermione muttered. "I want a quick word with Professor McGonagall."
"Probably trying to see if she can take any more classes," yawned Ron, as they made their way into the entrance hall, which was completely devoid of mad axemen.
When they reached the portrait hole, they found Sir Cadogan enjoying a Christmas party with a couple of monks, several previous headmasters of Hogwarts, and his fat pony. He pushed up his visor and toasted them with a flagon of mead.
"Merry Christmas. Password?"
"Scurvy cur," said Ron.
"And the same to you, sir,"
roared Sir Cadogan as the painting swung forward to admit them. Harry went straight up to the dormitory, collected his firebolt and the broomstick servicing kit Hermione had given him for his birthday, brought them downstairs, and tried to find something to do to the firebolt. However, there were no bent twigs to clip, and the handle was so shiny already it seemed pointless to polish it. He and Ron simply sat admiring it from every angle, until the portrait hole opened, and Hermione came in, accompanied by Professor McGonagall. Though Professor McGonagall was head of Gryffindor House, Harry had only seen her in the common room once before, and that had been to make a very grave announcement. He and Ron stared at her, both holding the firebolt. Hermione walked around them, sat down, picked up the nearest book, and hid her face behind it.
"So that's it, is it?" said Professor McGonagall beadily, walking over to the fireside and staring at the firebolt. "Miss Granger has just informed me that you have been sent a broomstick, Potter."
Harry and Ron looked around at Hermione. They could see her forehead reddening over the top of her book, which was upside down.
"May I?" said Professor McGonagall, but she didn't wait for an answer before pulling the firebolt out of their hands. She examined it carefully from handle to twig ends.
"And there was no note at all, Potter? No card? No message of any kind?"
"No," said Harry blankly.
"I see," said Professor McGonagall. "Well, I'm afraid I will have to take this, Potter."
"What?" said Harry, scrambling to his feet.
"Why?"
"It will need to be checked for jinxes," said Professor McGonagall.
"Of course, I'm no expert, but I dare say Madam Hooch and Professor Flitwick will strip it down.
"Strip it down?" repeated Ron, as though Professor McGonagall was mad.
"It shouldn't take more than a few weeks," said Professor McGonagall. "You will have it back if we are sure it is jinx-free."
"There's nothing wrong with it," said Harry, his voice shaking slightly. "Honestly, Professor."
"You can't know that, Potter," said Professor McGonagall quite kindly. "Not until you've flown it, at any rate, and I'm afraid that is out of the question until we are certain that it has not been tampered with. I shall keep you informed."
Professor McGonagall turned on her heel and carried the firebolt out of the portrait hole, which closed behind her. Harry stood staring after her, the tin of high-finish polish still clutched in his hands. Ron, however, rounded on Hermione.
"What did you go running to McGonagall for?"
Hermione threw her book aside. She was still pink in the face, but stood up and faced Ron defiantly.
"Because I thought, and Professor McGonagall agrees with me, that that broom was probably sent to Harry by Sirius Black."
Chapter 12. The Patronus. Harry knew that Hermione had meant well, but that didn't stop him being angry with her. He had been the owner of the best broom in the world for a few short hours, and now, because of her interference, he didn't know whether he would ever see it again. He was positive that there was nothing wrong with the firebolt now, but what sort of state would it be in once it had been subjected to all sorts of anti-jinx tests? Ron was furious with Hermione, too. As far as he was concerned, the stripping down of a brand new firebolt was nothing less than criminal damage. Hermione, who remained convinced that she had acted for the best, started avoiding the common room. Harry and Ron supposed she had taken refuge in the library and didn't try and persuade her to come back. All in all, they were glad when the rest of the school returned shortly after New Year and Gryffindor Tower became crowded and noisy again. Wood sought Harry out on the night before term started.
"Had a good Christmas?" he said,
and then, without waiting for an answer, he sat down, lowered his voice, and said,
"I've been doing some thinking over Christmas, Harry. After last match, you know. If the Dementors come to the next one, I mean, we can't afford you to... well..."
Wood broke off, looking awkward.
"I'm working on it," said Harry quickly. "Professor Lupin said he'd train me to ward the Dementors off. We should be starting this week. He said he'd have time after Christmas."
"Ah," said Wood, his expression clearing. "Well, in that case, I really didn't want to lose you as Seeker, Harry. And have you ordered a new broom yet?"
"No," said Harry.
"What? You'd better get a move on, you know. You can't ride that shooting star against Ravenclaw."
"He got a firebolt for Christmas," said Ron.
"A firebolt? No. Seriously? A real firebolt?"
"Don't get excited, Oliver," said Harry gloomily. "I haven't got it any more. It was confiscated." And he explained all about how the firebolt was now being checked for jinxes.
"Jinxed? How could it be jinxed?"
"Sirius Black," Harry said wearily. "He's supposed to be after me, so McGonagall reckons he might have sent it." Waving aside the information that a famous murderer was after his seeker, Wood said,
"But Black couldn't have bought a firebolt. He's on the run. The whole country's on the lookout for him. How could he just walk into Quality Quidditch Supplies and buy a broomstick?"
"I know," said Harry, "but McGonagall still wants to strip it down." Wood went pale.
"I'll go and talk to her, Harry," he promised. "I'll make her see reason. A firebolt, a real firebolt, on our team. She wants Gryffindor to win as much as we do. I'll make her see sense. A firebolt."
Lessons started again next day. The last thing anyone felt like doing was spending 2 hours in the grounds on a raw January morning, but Hagrid had provided a bonfire full of salamanders for their enjoyment, and they spent an unusually good lesson collecting dry wood and leaves to keep the fire blazing, while the flame-loving lizards scampered up and down the crumbling white-hot logs. The first divination lesson of the new term was much less fun. Professor Trelawney was now teaching them palmistry, and she lost no time in informing Harry that he had the shortest lifelines she had ever seen. It was defence against the dark arts that Harry was keen to get to. After his conversation with Wood, he wanted to get started on his anti-dementor lessons as soon as possible.
"Ah, yes," said Lupin, when Harry reminded him of his promise at the end of class. "Let me see. How about 8 o'clock on Thursday evening? The History of Magic classroom should be large enough. I'll have to think carefully about how we're going to do this. We can't bring a real dementor into the castle to practice on."
"Still looks ill, doesn't he?" said Ron, as they walked down the corridor, heading to dinner. "What do you reckon's the matter with him?"
There was a loud and impatient "tch!" from behind them. It was Hermione, who'd been sitting at the feet of a suit of armour, repacking her bag, which was so full of books it wouldn't close.
"And what are you tutting at us for?" said Ron, irritably.
"Nothing," said Hermione, in a lofty voice, heaving her bag back over her shoulder.
"Yes, you were," said Ron. "I said, I wonder what's wrong with Lupin, and you—well, isn't it obvious?" said Hermione, with a look of maddening superiority.
"If you don't want to tell us, don't," snapped Ron.
"Fine," said Hermione haughtily, and she marched off.
"She doesn't know," said Ron, staring resentfully after Hermione. "She's just trying to get us to talk to her again."
At 8 o'clock on Thursday evening, Harry left Gryffindor Tower for the History of Magic classroom. It was dark and empty when he arrived, but he lit the lamps with his wand and had waited only 5 minutes when Professor Lupin turned up, carrying a large packing case, which he heaved onto Professor Binns' desk.
"What's that?" said Harry.
"Another boggart," said Lupin, stripping off his cloak. "I've been combing the castle ever since Tuesday, and very luckily I found this one lurking inside Mr. Filch's filing cabinet. It's the nearest we'll get to a real Dementor. The boggart will turn into a Dementor when he sees you, so we'll be able to practice on him. I can store him in my office when we're not using him. There's a cupboard under my desk he'll like."
"Okay," said Harry, trying to sound as though he wasn't apprehensive at all, and merely glad that Lupin had found such a good substitute for a real Dementor.
"So," Professor Lupin had taken out his own wand and indicated that Harry should do the same. "The spell I am going to try and teach you is highly advanced magic, Harry, well beyond ordinary wizarding level. It is called the Patronus Charm."
"How does it work?" said Harry nervously.
"Well, when it works correctly, it conjures up a Patronus," said Lupin, "which is a kind of anti-Dementor, a guardian which acts as a shield between you and the Dementor."
Harry had a sudden vision of himself crouching behind a Hagrid-sized figure holding a large club.
Professor Lupin continued, "The Patronus is a kind of positive force, a projection of the very things that the Dementor feeds upon—hope, happiness, the desire to survive. But it cannot feel despair, as real humans can, so the Dementors can't hurt it. But I must warn you, Harry, that the charm might be too advanced for you. Many qualified wizards have difficulty with it."
"What does a Patronus look like?" said Harry, curiously.
"Each one is unique to the wizard who conjures it."
"And how do you conjure it?"
"With an incantation, which will work only if you are concentrating with all your might on a single, very happy memory."
Harry cast about for a happy memory. Certainly nothing that had happened to him at the Dursleys was going to do.
Finally, he settled on the moment when he had first ridden a broomstick.
"Right," he said, trying to recall as exactly as possible the wonderful soaring sensation in his stomach.
"The incantation is this."
Lupin cleared his throat.
"Expecto Patronum."
"Expecto Patronum," Harry repeated under his breath. "Expecto Patronum."
"Concentrating hard on your happy memory?"
"Oh, yeah," said Harry, quickly forcing his thoughts back to that first broom ride.
"Expecto Patrono. No, Patronum. Sorry. Expecto Patronum. Expecto Patronum."
Something whooshed suddenly out of the end of his wand. It looked like a wisp of silvery gas.
"Did you see that?" said Harry, excitedly. "Something happened."
"Very good," said Lupin, smiling.
"Right, then, ready to try it on a Dementor?"
"Yes," Harry said,
gripping his wand very tightly and moving into the middle of the deserted classroom. He tried to keep his mind on flying, but something else kept intruding. Any second now, he might hear his mother again. But he shouldn't think that, or he would hear her again, and he didn't want to. Or did he? Lupin grasped the lid of the packing case and pulled. A Dementor rose slowly from the box, its hooded face turned towards Harry, one glistening, scabbed hand gripping its cloak. The lamps around the classroom flickered and went out. The Dementor stepped from the box and started to sweep silently towards Harry, drawing a deep, rattling breath. A wave of piercing cold broke over him.
"Expecto Patronum!" Harry yelled. "Expecto Patronum! Expecto—"
But the classroom and the Dementor were dissolving. Harry was falling again through thick white fog, and his mother's voice was louder than ever, echoing inside his head.
"Not Harry! Not Harry! Please, I'll do anything!"
"Stand aside! Stand aside, girl!"
"Harry!" Harry jerked back to life. He was lying flat on his back on the floor. The classroom lamps were alight again. He didn't have to ask what had happened. "Sorry," he muttered, sitting up and feeling cold sweat trickling down behind his glasses. "Are you all right?" said Lupin. "Yes." Harry pulled himself up on one of the desks and leaned against it. "Here," Lupin handed him a chocolate frog. "Eat this before we try again. I didn't expect you to do it first time. In fact, I would have been astounded if you had." "It's getting worse," Harry muttered, biting the frog's head off. "I could hear her louder that time. And him. Voldemort." Lupin looked paler than usual. "Harry, if you don't want to continue, I will more than understand."
"I do," said Harry fiercely, stuffing the rest of the chocolate frog into his mouth. "I've got to. What if the Dementors turn up at our match against Ravenclaw? I can't afford to fall off again. If we lose this game, we've lost the Quidditch Cup."
"All right, then," said Lupin. "You might want to select another memory, a happy memory, I mean, to concentrate on. That one doesn't seem to have been strong enough." Harry thought hard and decided his feelings when Gryffindor had won the house championship last year had definitely qualified as very happy. He gripped his wand tightly again and took up his position in the middle of the classroom. "Ready?" said Lupin, gripping the box lid. "Ready," said Harry, trying hard to fill his head with happy thoughts about Gryffindor winning and not dark thoughts about what was going to happen when the box opened. "Go," said Lupin, pulling off the lid. The room went icily cold and dark once more. The Dementor glided forwards, drawing its rattly breath. One rotting hand was extending towards Harry.
"Expecto Patronum!" Harry yelled. "Expecto Patronum! Expecto Pat—"
White fog obscured his senses. Big, blurred shapes were moving around him. Then came a new voice, a man's voice, shouting, panicking.
"Lily, take Harry and go! It's him! Go! Run! I'll hold him off!"
The sounds of someone stumbling from a room, a door bursting open, a cackle of high-pitched laughter.
"Harry! Harry, wake up!"
Lupin was tapping Harry hard on the face. This time it was a minute before Harry understood why he was lying on a dusty classroom floor. "I heard my dad," Harry mumbled. "That's the first time I've ever heard him. He tried to take on Voldemort himself, to give my mum time to run for it." Harry suddenly realised that there were tears on his face mingling with the sweat. He bent his face low as possible, wiping them off his robes, pretending to do up his shoelace so that Lupin wouldn't see. "You heard James?" said Lupin in a strange voice. "Yeah." Face dry, Harry looked up. "Why, you didn't know my dad, did you?"
I did, as a matter of fact," said Lupin. "We were friends at Hogwarts. Listen, Harry, perhaps we should leave it here for tonight. This charm is ridiculously advanced. I shouldn't have suggested putting you through this."
"No," said Harry. He got up again. "I'll have one more go. I'm not thinking of happy enough things, that's what it is. Hang on." He racked his brains.
A really, really happy memory, one that he could turn into a good, strong Patronus. The moment when he'd first found out he was a wizard and would be leaving the Dursleys for Hogwarts. If that wasn't a happy memory, he didn't know what was. Concentrating very hard on how he had felt when he'd realised he'd be leaving Privet Drive, Harry got to his feet and faced the packing case once more.
"Ready?" said Lupin, who looked as though he was doing this against his better judgment.
"Concentrating hard. All right. Go." He pulled off the lid of the case for the third time, and the Dementor rose out of it. The room fell cold and dark.
"Expecto Patronum!" Harry bellowed. "Expecto Patronum! Expecto Patronum!"
The screaming inside Harry's head had started again, except this time it sounded as though it was coming from a badly tuned radio, softer and louder and softer again, and he could still see the Dementor. It had halted. And then a huge silver shadow came bursting out of the end of Harry's wand to hover between him and the Dementor, and though Harry's legs felt like water, he was still on his feet, though for how much longer he wasn't sure.
"Ridiculous!"
roared Lupin, springing forwards. There was a loud crack, and Harry's cloudy Patronus vanished along with the Dementor. He sank into a chair, feeling as exhausted as if he'd just run a mile, his legs shaking. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Professor Lupin forcing the boggart back into the packing case with his wand. It had turned into a silvery orb again.
"Excellent!" Lupin said, striding over to where Harry sat. "Excellent, Harry. That was definitely a start.
Can we have another go? Just one more go?"
"Not now," said Lupin firmly. "You've had enough for one night. Here."
He handed Harry a large bar of Honeyduke's best chocolate.
"Eat the lot, or Madame Pomfrey will be after my blood."
"Same time next week?"
"Okay,"
said Harry. He took a bite of the chocolate and watched Lupin extinguishing the lamps that had rekindled with the disappearance of the Dementor. A thought had just occurred to him.
"Professor Lupin," he said, "if you knew my dad, you must have known Sirius Black as well."
Lupin turned very quickly.
"What gives you that idea?" he said sharply.
"Nothing. I mean, I just knew they were friends at Hogwarts too." Lupin's face relaxed.
"Yes, I knew him," he said shortly. "Or I thought I did.
You'd better get off, Harry. It's getting late." Harry left the classroom, walked along the corridor and around a corner, then took a detour behind a suit of armour and sank down on its plinth to finish his chocolate, wishing he hadn't mentioned Black, as Lupin was obviously not keen on the subject. Then Harry's thoughts wandered back to his mother and father. He felt drained and strangely empty, even though he was so full of chocolate. Terrible though it was to hear his parents' last moments replayed inside his head, these were the only times Harry had heard their voices since he was a very small child. But he'd never be able to produce a proper Patronus if he half wanted to hear his parents again.
"They're dead," he told himself sternly. "They're dead, and listening to echoes of them won't bring them back. You'd better get a grip on yourself if you want that Quidditch cup."
He stood up, crammed the last bit of chocolate into his mouth, and headed back to Gryffindor Tower. Ravenclaw played Slytherin a week after the start of term. Slytherin won, though narrowly. According to Wood, this was good news for Gryffindor, who would take second place if they beat Ravenclaw too. He therefore increased the number of team practices to 5 a week. This meant that with Lupin's anti-Dementor classes, which in themselves were more draining than 6 Quidditch practices, Harry had just one night a week to do all his homework. Even so, he wasn't showing the strain nearly as much as Hermione, whose immense workload finally seemed to be getting to her. Every night, without fail, Hermione was to be seen in a corner of the common room, several tables spread with books, arithmancy charts, rune dictionaries, diagrams of muggles lifting heavy objects, and file upon file of extensive notes. She barely spoke to anybody, and snapped when she was interrupted. "How's she doing it?" Ron muttered to Harry one evening, as Harry sat finishing a nasty essay on undetectable poisons for Snape. Harry looked up. Hermione was barely visible behind a tottering pile of books.
"Doing what?"
"Getting to all her classes," Ron said. "I heard her talking to Professor Vector, that arithmancy witch, this morning. They were going on about yesterday's lesson, but Hermione can't have been there, because she was with us in care of magical creatures. And Ernie Macmillan told me she's never missed a Muggle Studies class, but half of them are at the same time as divination, and she's never missed one of them, either." Harry didn't have time to fathom the mystery of Hermione's impossible timetable at the moment. He really needed to get on with Snape's essay. 2 seconds later, however, he was interrupted again, this time by Wood.
"Bad news, Harry. I've just been to see Professor McGonagall about the firebolt. She got a bit shirty with me. Told me I got my priorities wrong. Seemed to think I cared more about winning the cup than I do about you staying alive. Just because I told her, I didn't care if it threw you off, as long as you caught the snitch on it first."
Wood shook his head in disbelief.
"Honestly, the way she was yelling at me, you'd think I'd said something terrible. Then I asked her how much longer she was going to keep it."
He screwed up his face and imitated McGonagall's severe voice.
"As long as necessary, Wood."
"I reckon it's time you ordered a new broom, Harry. There's an order form at the back of Witch Broomstick. You could get a Nimbus 2001, like Malfoy's got."
"I'm not buying anything Malfoy thinks is good," said Harry flatly. January faded imperceptibly into February, with no change in the bitterly cold weather. The match against Ravenclaw was drawing nearer and nearer, but Harry still hadn't ordered a new broom. He was now asking Professor McGonagall for news of the firebolt after every transfiguration lesson, Ron standing hopefully at his shoulder, Hermione rushing past with her face averted.
"No, Potter, you can't have it back yet,"
Professor McGonagall told him the 12th time this happened, before he'd even opened his mouth.
"We've checked for most of the usual curses, but Professor Flitwick believes the broom might be carrying a hurling hex. I shall tell you once we've finished checking it. Now please stop badgering me."
To make matters even worse, Harry's anti-dementor lessons were not going nearly as well as he had hoped. Several sessions on, he was able to produce an indistinct silvery shadow every time the boggart Dementor approached him, but his Patronus was too feeble to drive the Dementor away. All it did was hover like a semi-transparent cloud, draining Harry of energy as he fought to keep it there. Harry felt angry with himself, guilty about his secret desire to hear his parents' voices again.
"You're expecting too much of yourself," said Professor Lupin sternly in their fourth week of practice. "For a 13-year-old wizard, even an indistinct Patronus is a huge achievement. You aren't passing out any more, are you?"
"I thought a Patronus would charge the Dementors down or something," said Harry dispiritedly, "make them disappear."
"The true Patronus does do that," said Lupin, "but you've achieved a great deal in a very short space of time. If the Dementors put in an appearance at your next Quidditch match, you will be able to keep them at bay long enough to get back to the ground."
"You said it's harder if there are loads of them," said Harry.
"I have complete confidence in you," said Lupin, smiling. "Here, you've earned a drink, something from the Three Broomsticks. You won't have tried it before."
He pulled two bottles out of his briefcase.
"Butterbeer," said Harry, without thinking.
"Yeah, I like that stuff." Lupin raised an eyebrow.
"Oh, Ron and Hermione brought me some back from Hogsmeade," Harry lied quickly.
"I see," said Lupin, though he still looked slightly suspicious.
"Well, let's drink to a Gryffindor victory against Ravenclaw. Not that I'm supposed to take sides as a teacher," he added hastily.
They drank the butterbeer in silence, until Harry voiced something he'd been wondering for a while. "What's under a Dementor's hood?" Professor Lupin lowered his bottle thoughtfully.
"Well, the only people who really know are in no condition to tell us. You see, the Dementor only lowers its hood to use its last and worst weapon."
"What's that?"
"They call it the Dementor's kiss," said Lupin, with a slightly twisted smile. "It's what Dementors do to those they wish to destroy utterly.
I suppose there must be some kind of mouth under there, because they clamp their jaws upon the mouth of the victim and suck out his soul. Harry accidentally spat out a bit of butterbeer.
What, they kill?
Oh, no, said Lupin. Much worse than that. You can exist without your soul, you know, as long as your brain and heart are still working. But you'll have no sense of self any more, no memory, no anything. There's no chance at all of recovery. You'll just exist as an empty shell, and your soul is gone forever. Lost. Lupin drank a little more butterbeer, then said, It's the fate that awaits Sirius Black. It was in the Daily Prophet this morning. The Ministry have given the Dementors permission to perform it if they find him. Harry sat stunned for a moment at the idea of someone having their soul sucked out through their mouth. But then he thought of Black. He deserves it, he said suddenly.
You think so? Said Lupin lightly. Do you really think anyone deserves that?
Yes, said Harry defiantly. For some things. He would like to have told Lupin about the conversation he'd overheard about Black in the Three Broomsticks, about Black betraying his mother and father, but it would have involved revealing that he'd gone to Hogsmeade without permission, and he knew Lupin wouldn't be very impressed by that. So he finished his butterbeer, thanked Lupin, and left the History of Magic classroom. Harry half wished that he hadn't asked what was under a Dementor's hood. The answer had been so horrible, and he was so lost in unpleasant thoughts of what it would feel like to have your soul sucked out of you, that he walked headlong into Professor McGonagall halfway up the stairs.
"Do watch where you're going, Potter."
"Sorry, Professor. I've just been looking for you in the Gryffindor common room. Well, here it is. We've done everything we could think of, and there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with it at all. You've got a very good friend somewhere, Potter."
Harry's jaw dropped. She was holding out his firebolt, and it looked as magnificent as ever.
"I can have it back," Harry said weakly.
"Seriously?"
"Seriously," said Professor McGonagall, and she was actually smiling. "I dare say you'll need to get the feel of it before Saturday's match, won't you? And Potter, do try and win, won't you? Or we'll be out of the running for the 8th year in a row, as Professor Snape was kind enough to remind me only last night."
Speechless, Harry carried the firebolt back upstairs towards Gryffindor Tower. As he turned a corner, he saw Ron dashing towards him, grinning from ear to ear.
"She gave it to you! Excellent! Listen, can I still have a go on it tomorrow?"
"Yeah, anything,"
said Harry, his heart lighter than it had been in a month.
"You know what? We should make it up with Hermione. She was only trying to help."
"Yeah, all right," said Ron. "She's in the common room now, working, for a change." They turned into the corridor to Gryffindor Tower and saw Neville Longbottom pleading with Sir Cadogan, who seemed to be refusing him entrance.
"I wrote them down," Neville was saying tearfully, "but I must have dropped them somewhere."
"A likely tale," roared Sir Cadogan.
Then, spotting Harry and Ron,
"Good even, my fine young yeoman. Come, clap this loon in irons. He's trying to force entry to the chambers within."
"Oh, shut up," said Ron, as he and Harry drew level with Neville.
"I've lost the passwords," Neville told them miserably. "I made him tell me what passwords he was going to use this week, because he keeps changing them, and now I don't know what I've done with them."
"Odds bodikins," said Harry to Sir Cadogan, who looked extremely disappointed, and reluctantly swung forwards to let them into the common room. There was a sudden excited murmur as every head turned, and the next moment Harry was surrounded by people exclaiming over his firebolt.
"Where'd you get it, Harry? Will you let me have a go?"
"Have you ridden it yet, Harry?"
"Ravenclaw'll have no chance. They're all on clean sweep sevens." "Can I just hold it, Harry?"
After 10 minutes or so, during which the firebolt was passed around and admired from every angle, the crowd dispersed, and Harry and Ron had a clear view of Hermione, the only person who hadn't rushed over to them, bent over her work and carefully avoiding their eyes. Harry and Ron approached her table, and at last she looked up.
"I got it back,"
said Harry, grinning at her and holding up the firebolt.
"See, Hermione, there wasn't anything wrong with it," said Ron.
"Well, there might have been," said Hermione. "I mean,
At least you know now that it's safe.
Yeah, I suppose so, said Harry. I'd better put it upstairs.
I'll take it, said Ron, eagerly. I've got to give Scabbers his rat tonic.
He took the firebolt, and holding it as if it were made of glass, carried it away up the boys' staircase.
Can I sit down, then? Harry asked Hermione.
I suppose so, said Hermione, moving a great stack of parchment off a chair.
Harry looked around at the cluttered table, at the long arithmancy essay on which the ink was still glistening, at the even longer Muggle Studies essay, Explain Why Muggles Need Electricity, and at the rune translation Hermione was now poring over.
How are you getting through all this stuff? Harry asked her.
Oh, well, you know, working hard, said Hermione. Close to, Harry saw that she looked almost as tired as Lupin.
"Why don't you just drop a couple of subjects?" Harry asked, watching her lifting books as she searched for her rune dictionary.
"I couldn't do that," said Hermione, looking scandalized.
"Arithmancy looks terrible," said Harry, picking up a very complicated-looking number chart.
"Oh, no, it's wonderful," said Hermione earnestly. "It's my favourite subject. It's—"
But exactly what was wonderful about arithmancy Harry never found out. At that precise moment, a strangled yell echoed down the boys' staircase. The whole common room fell silent, staring, petrified at the entrance. There came hurried footsteps, growing louder and louder, and then Ron came leaping into view, dragging with him a bedsheet.
"Look!"
he bellowed, striding over to Hermione's table.
"Look!"
he yelled, shaking the sheets in her face.
"Ron, what—"
"Scabbers! Look! Scabbers!"
Hermione was leaning away from Ron, looking utterly bewildered. Harry looked down at the sheet Ron was holding. There was something red on it, something that looked horribly like—
"Blood!"
Ron yelled into the stunned silence.
"He's gone! And you know what was on the floor?"
No, said Hermione in a trembling voice.
Ron threw something down onto Hermione's rune translation. Hermione and Harry leaned forward. Lying on top of the weird, spiky shapes were several long ginger cat hairs.
Chapter 13. Gryffindor versus Ravenclaw. It looked like the end of Ron and Hermione's friendship. Each was so angry with the other that Harry couldn't see how they'd ever make it up. Ron was enraged that Hermione had never taken Crookshanks's attempts to eat Scabbers seriously, hadn't bothered to keep a close enough watch on him, and was still trying to pretend that Crookshanks was innocent by suggesting Ron look for Scabbers under all the boys' beds. Hermione, meanwhile, maintained fiercely that Ron had no proof that Crookshanks had eaten Scabbers, that the ginger hairs might have been there since Christmas, and that Ron had been prejudiced against her cat ever since Crookshanks had landed on Ron's head in the magical menagerie. Personally, Harry was sure that Crookshanks had eaten Scabbers, and when he tried to point out to Hermione that the evidence all pointed that way, she lost her temper with Harry, too.
"Okay, side with Ron. I knew you would," she said shrilly. "First the firebolt, now Scabbers. Everything's my fault, isn't it? Just leave me alone, Harry. I've got a lot of work to do."
Ron had taken the loss of his rat very hard indeed.
"Come on, Ron. You were always saying how boring Scabbers was," said Fred bracingly, "and he's been off colour for ages. He was wasting away. It was probably better for him to snuff it quickly. One swallow, he probably didn't feel a thing."
"Fred!" said Ginny indignantly.
"All he did was eat and sleep, Ron. You said it yourself," said George.
"He bit Goyle for us once," Ron said miserably. "Remember, Harry?"
"Yeah, that's true," said Harry.
"His finest hour," said Fred, unable to keep a straight face.
"Let the scar on Goyle's finger stand as a lasting tribute to his memory."
"Oh, come on, Ron. Get yourself down to Hogsmeade and buy a new rat. What's the point of moaning?"
In a last-ditch attempt to cheer Ron up, Harry persuaded him to come along to the Gryffindor team's final practice before the Ravenclaw match, so that he could have a go on the firebolt after they'd finished. This did seem to take Ron's mind off Scabbers for a moment.
"Brilliant! Can I try and shoot a few goals on it?"
so they set off for the Quidditch pitch together. Madame Hooch, who was still overseeing Gryffindor practices to keep an eye on Harry, was just as impressed with the firebolt as everyone else had been. She took it in her hands before take-off and gave them the benefit of her professional opinion.
"Look at the balance on it. If the Nimbus series has a fault, it's a slight list to the tail end. You often find they develop a drag after a few years. They've updated the handle, too, a bit slimmer than the clean sweeps. Reminds me of the old silver arrows. Pity they've stopped making them. I learned to fly on one, and a very fine old broom it was, too."
She continued in this vein for some time, until Wood said,
"Madam Hooch, is it okay if Harry has the firebolt back, only we need to practice?"
"Oh, right. Here you are then, Potter," said Madame Hooch. "I'll sit over here with Weasley."
She and Ron left the pitch to sit in the stadium, and the Gryffindor team gathered around Wood for his final instructions for tomorrow's match.
"Harry, I've just found out who Ravenclaw are playing as Seeker. It's Cho Chang. She's a fourth year, and she's pretty good. I really hoped she wouldn't be fit. She's had some problems with injuries."
Wood scowled his displeasure that Cho Chang had made a full recovery, then said,
"On the other hand, she rides a Comet 260, which is going to look like a joke next to the Firebolt."
He gave Harry's broom a look of fervent admiration, then said,
"Okay, everyone, let's go."
And at long last, Harry mounted his Firebolt and kicked off from the ground. It was better than he'd ever dreamed. The Firebolt turned with the lightest touch. It seemed to obey his thoughts rather than his grip. It sped across the pitch at such speed that the stadium turned into a green and grey blur. Harry turned it so sharply that Alicia Spinett screamed. Then he went into a perfectly controlled dive, brushing the grassy pitch with his toes before rising 30, 40, 50 feet into the air again.
"Harry, I'm letting the snitch out," Wood called.
Harry turned and raced a bludger towards the goalposts. He outstripped it easily, saw the snitch dart out from behind Wood, and within 10 seconds had caught it tightly in his hand. The team cheered madly. Harry let the snitch go again, gave it a minute's head start, then tore after it, weaving in and out of the others. He spotted it lurking near Katie Bell's knee, looped her easily, and caught it again. It was the best practice ever. The team, inspired by the presence of the Firebolt in their midst, performed their best moves faultlessly, and by the time they hit the ground again, Wood didn't have a single criticism to make, which, as George Weasley pointed out, was a first.
"I can't see what's going to stop us tomorrow," said Wood. "Not unless... Harry, you've sorted your Dementor problem, haven't you?"
"Yeah," said Harry, thinking of his feeble Patronus and wishing it was stronger.
"The Dementors won't turn up again, Oliver. Dumbledore do his nut," said Fred, confidently. "Well, let's hope not," said Wood. "Anyway, good work, everyone. Let's get back to the tower. Turn in early."
"I'm staying out for a bit. Ron wants to go on the Firebolt," Harry told Wood, and while the rest of the team headed off to the changing rooms, Harry strode over to Ron, who vaulted the barrier to the stands and came to meet him. Madame Hooch had fallen asleep in her seat.
"Here you go," said Harry, handing Ron the Firebolt.
Ron, an expression of ecstasy on his face, mounted the broom and zoomed off into the gathering darkness, while Harry walked around the edge of the pitch, watching him. Night had fallen before Madame Hooch awoke with a start, told Harry and Ron off for not waking her, and insisted that they go back to the castle. Harry shouldered the Firebolt, and he and Ron walked out of the shadowy stadium, discussing the Firebolt's superbly smooth action, its phenomenal acceleration, and its pinpoint turning. They were halfway towards the castle when Harry, glancing to his left, saw something that made his heart turn over. A pair of eyes gleaming out of the darkness.